way the story was relayed to me was the guy stopped my dad and said, "How's it going?" "It's pretty good." And he says, "Well, what do you think of all this?" And my dad says, "I don't understand what the hell he's doing, but it's working."
Welcome to the 337th installment of Ear to the Ground, the Land Stewardship Project's podcast on family farming, regenerative agriculture, community food systems, and local democracy. I'm Brian DeVore, editor of the Land Stewardship Letter. Okay, time for a little finance 101. The official definition of return on investment, also known as ROI, is that it's a performance measure used to evaluate the efficiency or profitability of an investment or a number of different investments. ROI basically tries to directly measure the amount of return on a particular investment relative to the investment's cost. To calculate ROI, the benefit or return of an investment is divided by the cost of the investment. In farming, the ROI of raising a corn crop, for example, might be the cost of all the inputs, fuel, fertilizer, herbicides, land, and labor, calculated against the price the farmer receives for each bushel harvested and delivered to the elevator or ethanol plant. All well and good, but during a recent LSP soil health workshop, North Central Iowa farmer Josh Nelson gave a presentation where he added a new twist to ROI. Josh raises corn, soybeans, and small grains, as well as finishes hogs, on a family operation. For the past few years, he's been using cover cropping, no-till, strip-till, diverse rotations, and manure applications to build soil health. Josh reports that the systems approach he's using to create more biologically healthy soil is not only producing less of a reliance on expensive inputs and better yields, but also other non-monetary results that, in his opinion, boost the operation's overall ROI. For example, soil that's not as reliant on chemical inputs and doesn't erode is good for the environment, which Josh sees as a key component of a good return on investment. In addition, spending less time in the tractor doing tillage means more time with his family, which the farmer also sees as an important return to optimize. Josh realizes that taking into consideration such factors as clean water and time with family doesn't fit neatly into a spreadsheet. But he feels when one takes a long-term systems approach to farming, rather than just basing everything on how to produce that next high-yielding corn crop, such an integrated approach to return on investment makes the farm more sustainable. That means realizing that the things one does now can have impacts years down the road. That's certainly the case when it comes to practices that might not have an immediate financial return, but are investing in the kind of soil that can be productive and resilient long into the future. It also means not making the mistake of always equating high crop yields with a good ROI ratio. After the workshop, I talked to Josh about the systems approach to calculating a return on investment and why it's important for farmers to earn the right to drop certain inputs when making changes to their operation. The farmer also described how his journey toward building soil health profitably reminds him of when he was teaching his son to ride a bike without training wheels.
Farming's interesting because we've got a goal every year. You know, Lauren Steinlog, he said it to me earlier today, that farmers get 40 crops. Mm-hmm. Another way to look at that, he said, is that we get 40 experiences, you know. So every year we're thinking specifically about that goal at the end of the year of what we're going to do. When Mother Nature starts to act up, or economics, you know, we're dealing with a pretty steep decline in commodity prices, people start to think, what am I going to do to get through this year? If you were in a business, any kind of business, you wouldn't think just, what am I going to do to get through the next 12 calendar months? You'd think, how am I going to maintain a profit year to year? You'd be doing all sorts of different metrics. Farmers really ought to be doing that the same, not only from an economic cycle standpoint, you know, the year-to-year economic cycles, but they need to think about it from an ecological standpoint, because the things you do now affect you not just next year, the year after, long time, you know, a long time change. If you were to switch and say do a corn-on-corn program this year because corn's more profitable, you've just locked yourself in for another 3 years of practices, because you're going to have to, you know, potentially make the decision next year, and then the year after that, and the year after that. The reverberations are there, and there's nothing to say that you can't make decisions on the fly. The one thing I forgot to get into with my presentation was the ability to be adaptable, to change when conditions warrant. But you also have to understand that everything, every decision you make has a knock-on effect. So if you're treating things like a system, if you've got principles that influence your decisions that underline the processes that you're thinking through, you know, then you can kind of be a little more confident in how you do things. I've seen in our own operation and lots of guys in my area, when they're just making these momentary reactions, a lot of times it might be made based on emotion, it might be based on other factors, it may just be them not thinking that far ahead, or being confined to a certain kind of thinking. And a lot of times that might work, but, you know, when it blows up, it could be really problematic.
Well, the one example you used was raising oats. That if you just look at that as a single crop situation, a single crop year, maybe it doesn't make economic sense, but you found that it kind of, when you're looking at it maybe 3 years down the road, you kind of crunch the numbers, it really does make sense.
Yeah, and it's multiple things, but, you know, when you take that oat crop, let's say right now I think the cash bid for one of our food grade mills in the area is about $4.50. You know, that's still going to probably be corn, but in a really good price year like we've just been coming off of, it's hard for people to argue that that's going to be a profitable system, especially in my area where the cash rents are approaching $400 or $500 an acre. But lots of guys have found that when they treat it like a system, a multi-year, three-part system, they can still make a cash flow, because in an oat year, you're going to be potentially spending less on seeds, spending less on fertilizer, spending less on your crops. If you harvest the straw, you've got another income stream. If you don't harvest the straw, you've got all the plant available nutrients that were in the straw that you've left in the field for the subsequent crop. It gives you time to grow another cover crop that can improve the soil for the length of the growing season. Right. For, you know, and you got a long time from when oats are harvested in July or August to when it freezes. So you've got all that amount of time. You can put manure on if you need to. You can graze it if you need to. These are, you know, all different functions of the same system. But what that ends up doing over time is it creates less inputs for your subsequent corn crop. You might be doing a better job of controlling problem weeds like ragweed or some of these other things. And then over time, you're going to start to see that not only are you spending less money, so you're more financially resilient, your soil's improving, so you become more weather or climate resilient, and your crops are getting healthier, so they're becoming resilient on their own. And so once you start to see how the pieces fit together, you understand that these are systems, these are multiple outcomes that build on each other. And similar, you know, you could have a poorly functioning system that causes you to, you know, end up in bankruptcy court a little faster.
Right. Yeah, it can be a negative system or a positive system. Yeah. Yeah, both ways. Yeah, I think that's a really good example. One of the things that you really talked about too was we get really stuck on equating yields with ROI. And it is a factor, but it can't be the only factor, really, if you're going to be resilient in the long term.
Right. In my presentation, I talked about shooting for 200 bushel corn, and that's kind of become my standard. I would love to harvest 300 bushel corn someday, but when I think about it, I have to look at the realistic situation. This is kind of where adaptability comes in. If I'm starting at 250 at the beginning of the year and then it never rains, but 200 is an achievable goal within my system, then I'm going to go for that. If I plan for 200 at the beginning and I overshoot that, you know, well, that's just pure profit. If you're going out there to get that last five bushel, if you're reaching really hard to get those last little bit of stretch goals and it's costing you more than you're getting in return, then you really got to reassess what your actual goals are. Are you just searching for yield, or are you searching to be a profitable business? And I think that's where a lot of guys struggle with the concept of ROI. They'll hear the salesman say, this is a five bushel gain. Everything gets you five bushel. You know, you go to the farm show and you can get 300 bushel walking through the alleys picking, you know.
It's just by being there.
Yeah, you don't even have to plant a crop and you've got bumper crop. But some of those things are real. Some of them do get you money. Some of them don't. Some of them are just expensive. But I think when you kind of treat, you know, going back to the systems approach, and you start to treat things like a system, you have achievable goals and practices in place. That's when you start to understand what real ROI is. And it's not just talking about, you know, what you spend. Sometimes it's time. You know, I've got two little girls at home. I want to spend time with them. You know, I'm concerned about the environment. I don't want to overextend my ecosystem or do things that are damaging. Those are all returns on investment. You know, if I invest my time in good, sustainable practices, I might get more time with my kids. I might get more money at the end of the day. My body won't hurt from sitting in the tractor all the time. You know, so there's a lot of things that aren't just financial. But sometimes when you think about how to deal with things in a systems approach, you do get the financial benefit.
You admitted this from your thing that you borrowed this from Gary Zimmer. But it's this idea about earning the right, maybe earning the right to cut inputs or earning the right to rely more on biology. You talk a little bit, that sounds like that's been a really key thing for you as you've made some of these changes in your farming operation, is being aware of you've got to earn that right. You can't just go cold turkey on certain things or go 100% on something.
I mean, if you look at what our soils are doing now and what our biology and our farm systems are doing now, everything's really kind of been propped up, you know, the corn crop, everything, or the bean crop or whatever, we're fertilizing to get a crop. We're not letting natural systems do the work that they're supposed to, or accommodate the things that we're doing. You know, and these aren't things that they can be destroyed overnight, but they aren't going to be rebuilt quickly. So when Gary talks about it, when I talk about it, when I've heard other people in other states talk about it, when you earn the right, you're letting your biology not only rebuild, but you're understanding what the system is doing and how you can change it, how the things that you're doing affect the system. Because I've seen lots of guys go out and say, I'm gonna, you know, they learn about regenerative ag, they get religion, they want to go out there and cut because, you know, they said that Gabe Brown does this, you know. And they don't understand that it probably took Gabe, you know, decades to get to where he's at, and some of it was just pure luck of the system. But it's also Gabe understanding and observing and paying attention to what he's doing. And if you just go out there one day and cut cold turkey, you're going to have a disaster on your hands. And I think that's what happened with a lot of guys when they were going no-till in the 90s, or you see it now with some of these guys that put cover crops on and they don't get any help from anybody, or they get the wrong kind of help, and then it's just a disaster on their hands because they weren't coached on how to do it, or they weren't paying close enough attention, or they thought that all I gotta do is sell my field cultivator and plant my corn and everything's gonna take care of itself. It takes time. It takes a lot of work. It takes as much work as your conventional farmer puts in doing all the tillage and everything else. It's just that instead of exercising the machine, sometimes it's exercising your body or your brain to understand what's going on.
I think, like Gary said, sometimes the biggest compaction problem is between your ears.
Yeah. I love, to steal another thing, I think Dale Strickler at Green Cover always says, you know, when he hears it doesn't work here, it always starts on your right ear and ends on your left ear. So, you know, these ideas work just about anywhere if you approach them with the correct mindset and you let things work the way they're supposed to.
Do you recall when you realized, or was there an event or a season when you realized you've earned the right to maybe do some things, to drop some inputs or to change things?
I think, you know, there's a couple of years ago, back when it still rained, I was working a pretty light field, and I ended up hearing the second hand, but it kind of made me rethink it. One of our farmhands stopped my dad, who was running the combine, and we were just having phenomenal corn. This is a really light field, literal sand, just 4 inches down. And we were getting 200 plus corn off there, you know, and hog manure, cover crops, you know, all sorts of different things. And the way the story was relayed to me was the guy stopped my dad and said, how's it going? pretty good. And he says, well, what do you think of all this? And my dad says, I don't understand what the hell he's doing, but it's working. And, you know, I never heard that when Dad was alive, but when I heard that later on, I was like, well, maybe I'm ready for the next step. But I also had a lot of people that were just willing, mentors. You know, I mentioned Lauren Steinlage or Dave Brand or Dean Sponheim, some of these guys in my area that basically let me kind of know that maybe I'm ready. You know, just do it.
Yeah.
Was kind of their approach. And then when you have somebody that's willing to just kind of give you a bit of confidence and stand behind you with help, you find that you can do a lot more than you realize you're able to. It's kind of like, you know, when I taught my son how to ride a bike, he was going down the bike trail and didn't even realize I'd stopped following him.
Yeah.
You know, he was convinced he couldn't ride a bike. And, you know, that summer I couldn't keep him off the bike. At a certain point, you learn how to take the training wheels off, but you just need somebody to be there to let you know they've got your back, even if they stop holding you.
Well, that's a really good analogy, and I think you said that in some ways it's you kind of had an eye opener when you realized biology could play a much bigger role than, for example, I guess the other thing you were describing was too many times we use fertilizer as the only way to raise that crop, where it really should be almost like a gap insurance or a way to kind of to fill in some gaps. But it instead of it being the driver of the system, really biology needs to be the driver of the system.
A friend of mine in Kansas says this a lot, but I think farmers are convinced sometimes that we are the only thing keeping that crop alive. Like, if we aren't doing something, if we don't put the anhydrous down, if we don't put the potash, or if we're not putting, you know, 150 pounds of MAP down in the fall, then everything's going to die.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, the prairie and bison, you know, seeded, fertilized itself. Natural systems work. There's times where you just got to say it's okay doing nothing. There's also times where you got to intervene, because farming is not, it's been around for 10,000 years, but it's not natural. We're making things making plants and things not, you know, do things that they're not supposed to, but we still work within the context of Mother Nature. So when you understand that you're a partner of biology, then you can figure out how to do things a little more effectively. So it's not so much work. It's actually a little more fun, you know? Like, you could go out and count the painted turtles in your no-till field because they're going after worms, and you could do fun things like that instead of stressing out about how your seed bed's not perfect because your field cultivator was a little bit off or whatever. I didn't use biology or bugs in the jug, you know, biological additives. I use biostimulants. I use things that are designed to just like what they say, they stimulate the plant, or they stimulate the biology. Ideally, they're going to do both.
Right.
Something like a humic acid or a kelp will feed the biology and feed the plant at the same time to increase some of the symbiosis that goes on without having to introduce wild strains. Like, there's certain products I know that work that are claim, you know, 800 or whatever more strains of microbes. And I know enough about their products not to name any, but I know that they work fairly well. I also know that in good functioning soils, you might not need those specific biological species, but you will need something to feed them.
Yeah.
You know, and that's where the biostimulants come in, and that's where you can improve your efficiency on some of these metrics without having to resort to extreme measures or you know, suffer. Especially when I think about the weather that we've had. You know, when I use something like a humic acid to improve my nitrogen uptake, it allows the plant to be more efficient with the water use, and it can decrease the plant stress. And so therefore, you know, when we're stressed out, we perform badly. I get sick. I think the same is true of the plant. And anything I can do out there to relieve the stress of that plant is going to be a benefit at the end.
Yeah, it's kind of the difference between just, like you said, using, basically giving that plant a crutch and supporting it in any way. So once you leave the picture, or you take that out of the picture, it fails, and kind of making it a self-perpetuating system, kind of letting it cook up its own fertility and its own kind of healthy way of kind of interacting with the soil. It's kind of like a kickstart kind of thing.
Yeah, to quote my Kansas friend again, he says, you know, he feels like half the time the plants are recovering from the stuff we screw up or we do to them, you know. So I don't know how true that is in Iowa, where, you know, we have a bit friendlier climate, but there are plenty of times where I've gone out and screwed up a corn crop or a bean crop because I thought I needed to do something, and then spent the rest of the summer wondering if I made the right decision. There's also plenty of times where I just should have probably acted, there's a happy medium there, and that's where I really feel like a lot of this comes in, and it's unfortunately the kind of thing that you have to learn through experience, but hopefully, you know, we're building a good enough network that some of this experience can be learned through osmosis or you know, some other way.
You are using cover cropping and no-till and diverse rotations, kind of the big three of soil health, so some of the big things. Is there some things that you are, it sounds like you're not, how old are you? 42. You're 42. You're a young guy. You're a young farmer yet. It sounds like you're not afraid to innovate and experiment. Is there something you'd like to, you're looking into or that you've heard about that you'd like to give a try, that kind of the next steps?
I've been reluctant. I really want to try relay cropping. And the other thing that I'm super fascinated with is biostrip till, where you take a some sort of winter kill species and then you plant it. I want to do this after like oats or my when my rye crop comes off, where I take like a fava bean or some tillage radish or something, and you plant that with a planter, put it in a strip, and then when winter comes around, it'll die off, and then you'll have that black strip in the spring. That I probably talked to more people about that. I haven't been able to figure out the logistics on that. Same with relay cropping, where you raise, say, rye and soybeans in the same field. You take the rye off, then you let the soybeans grow up. I haven't pulled the trigger on that. I just haven't gotten confident enough. Some of it's the drought. I'm technically involved in a trial for 2024. If we get rain, they're talking drought buster rains. If we get rain, maybe I'll be confident enough to do it. But at the same time, I've got some other ideas I want to try on that same farm. So if I have to kill off that rye instead of doing relay crop, I'm not probably going to be too sad about it.
Do you have any suggestions for someone who's just, maybe they're doing a lot of conventional things, or maybe they're just maybe a beginning farmer or whatever, who just wants to get their feet wet without making a kind of a business breaking risk, taking some risks that maybe is going to break the bank or whatever, but just to kind of get your feet wet, a low risk entry into something like this?
Yeah, one of the easiest is usually like a cereal rye ahead of soybeans. The nice thing there is that even if your equipment can't handle it, you know, for whatever reason, you got a planter or a drill that can't get in the ground, you could still kill it. Another super cheap thing to do is to go find somebody that's doing these things and ask them questions. I wouldn't be able to have a third of the confidence I have in doing any of this if I hadn't taken the time to drive to a meeting and ask a dumb question and feel like the biggest village idiot around. But all these folks are here to teach and we're all here to learn. And so I think that's the best thing we can do for a novice in this stuff is to ask a question and don't be afraid of the answer, and then go do the thing you just learned about. You know?
And before you know it, you're riding that bicycle down the sidewalk and you turn around and there's nobody pushing you.
There you go. Yeah, the training wheels are off and you're ready to go hot dog it down the road. Just don't fall and skid your knee.
For more on building soil health profitably, see the podcast page for Ear to the Ground episode 337 at landstewardshipproject.org. If you have comments or suggestions about this podcast, contact Brian DeVore at bdevore@landstewardshipproject.org, or you can call 612-816-9342. By the way, it helps us greatly if you can give Ear to the Ground a rating on whatever podcast platform you utilize. And word of mouth is the best way to spread the news about our podcast. If you like what you hear, tell at least one person about LSP's Ear to the Ground. Thanks to Laura Borgendale, a Western Minnesota musician, for Ear to the Ground's theme music. And a special thank you to all of Land Stewardship Project's members who make initiatives such as this podcast possible. If you're not a member, visit landstewardshipproject.org to learn how you can support LSP. Thanks for listening. Thank you.